Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, and today's conversation is with Dr. David Hsu, Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness for the Department of Defense. And joining us in our conversation is Bill Phillips.
David, can you talk to us a little bit about the efforts at the Department's human capital transformation process? How do the different pieces fit together, and how is that going to impact the overall mission of the department?
Well, I'm delighted to do so. Let me start with why we are trying to change things. We recognize it's a different world than the one that characterized the Cold War. The Cold War is over. The United States, as we all know, faces a different set of military problems. We have to have the right kind of people with the right set of skills that are appropriate to that new set of problems. The other thing, of course, that changes is American society. It's a society a lot more educated than was true before. It's a society where families have different aspirations than might have been true in earlier years. One of the most important changes is that most young Americans now want to go on to college reasonably soon after they finish high school. In the old days, so to speak, I'm almost old enough to be able to say that, most high school graduates went out and got a job. And so the competition, so to speak, was not college, it was the job market. Given all these changes, we have to change both what we're aiming at and how we're going to get there. And that's what the human capital transformation is all about. To do that, what we've tried to do is to borrow from the business playbook, develop a set of strategic plans that look forward. In other words, instead of back to what our past practices were, let's look forward to what our future practices ought to be. And separately for the military and civil forces of the department, we have a set of efforts that are intended to give us those strategic guidelines. And I can say more about that in just a few minutes. At the same time, for both the civilians and military, we recognize that in a key part of why someone would want to join and stay with our organization and really work hard and contribute well to the organization is the set of understandings between us and them of what this position, what this commitment is going to be like, what the social compact is, so to speak, emphasizing that we're all in this together. This is not us versus them, not employees versus management. We have a combined interest here. And so, yes, we're going to ask you to do some difficult things and to take on some fairly significant burdens, and particularly in the military case, to risk your life or your health in the process. But at the same time, we're prepared to do various things to make sure that you're well taken care of. And part of what we want to do for both the civilian and military forces of the department is be sure that social compact is in good shape, that we are appropriately taking care of you. This doesn't mean coddling people. It means being sure that their circumstances are what they find attractive, that makes them want to come to work in the morning, want to contribute. The terrific spirit we saw on September 12th, when the Secretary of Defense made a decision that, if at all possible, the Pentagon would reopen after that attack. And I was really struck at the awe in the tone of media reporting that, my God, all these thousands of civilian military personnel are trooping back in this building while the building was literally still burning. And no one had any hesitation about coming back to work. That kind of dedication is why you want to be sure that people are well taken care of.
You mentioned the strategic plan and linking the human capital to that. Could you tell us a little bit about that strategic plan?
Yes. We start by asking ourselves, both the military and civilians, what kind of skills are we going to need in this future world that we face? And then, of course, and that's a large debate. Obviously, there are going to be different opinions about that debate. I think the common element for both military and civil personnel is this is going to be a more educated force in the future. And so the old view that a high school diploma was enough, and that on the military side, let's say, and that we didn't really care very much if you got any further formal education or not, that's out. We recognize that both for our good and for your to meet your desires, most young people enlisting in the military are going to want to continue their education. So we have a whole set of programs designed to respond to that. And part of the strategic plan issue is, how do we position these programs correctly? So how much should we do on tuition assistance, for example? The Army has a wonderful program called Army College Online, in which if you meet various criteria, they will give you a, quote, free computer that allows you to do courses from various universities on an online basis. Impressive results. I happened to be at Fort Lewis the day they were giving out the computers, even though they had emphasized there were plenty of computers for everybody. that you didn't have to work. People were there in line at 4 a.m. in the morning to make sure that they were going to get their computers. And these were not just privates. There were people wearing quite a lot of stripes on their arms who were there making sure they got the computer and saw them signing up for their courses and so on and so forth. So there's a terrific thirst for continuing education on the part of our people. We want to slake that thirst because we recognize it's also in our own interest. So defining what we need, thinking through what we're going to have to do to attract, retain, and motivate those people is the essence of what these plans are all about. And so what they consist of is a series of, as we were phrasing it, lines of operation. In other words, areas we have to pay attention to. And then within each, the specific steps we'll need to take in order to achieve the results that we want.
Let me just extend that thought a little bit. You've talked about some of the challenges you face with respect to college as an alternative to the military. You've talked about some of the programs that the Army has in place. What are the key things that the department needs to continue to attract young people to the military?
Well, one of the first things that you have to do always is to make sure that your compensation package is fair, competitive. No one's going to get rich serving in the military, but they shouldn't have to absorb undue financial burden either. And so you have to constantly pay attention to what are we competing against. And that's one of the big changes taking place that we have to react to. 20 years ago, the standard for thinking about enlisted compensation in the military was what could a high school diploma graduate make in the American economy? That's no longer relevant. If most young Americans, particularly the ones we want, seek to go on to college, the standard is what could someone with some college education, let's say a year or two, make in the American economy? That's a very different set of numbers. It's a higher set of numbers. The president has responded to that by saying that a part of our pay raise the last 2 years should be targeted to the mid-range in terms of experience of our both enlisted and officer communities, because in both those areas, we're kind of weak when you, on the enlisted side, vetted against the some college earnings line. We were not competitive, and we still aren't as competitive in that regard as we want to be. So we're slowly trying to bring our compensation level up. But it also means, back to what you mentioned earlier, that we have to convince young people regarding college. It's not either or. The military is not an alternative college. We have to give you the chance to continue your education while you're in the military. Or the military could be the vehicle by which you accumulate the savings, the Montgomery GI Bill being the example, so that you can, post-military service, resume a college education. So we're trying to position ourselves so that it's not either or, that you can do both. You can have your cake and eat it too, and that's what we're trying to tell young people.
You mentioned earlier the strategy for civilian members of the Department of Defense. Could you contrast that with the military strategy for HR?
We are starting from a much lower base with civilians. I think it's true of the federal government at large and certainly the Department of Defense that we have not thought about our civilians as the kind of strategic resource they truly are. And so, and one of the things I think that's giving everybody a wake-up call on this front is the coming wave of federal retirements. Everyone understands that because the civil workforce has been managed on a decentralized basis, what we have is a workforce with a lot of people nearing retirement age. Standard number is in 5 years, half this federal workforce could retire. That number applies to DoD as well. Now, not all people are going to retire when they become eligible, and so it's not upon us quite as rapidly as some of the doomsayers may assert. But certainly in the next 10 to 15 years, the way we see it strategically as a problem within defense, we have to recruit a number of people equal to approximately half our current workforce. That's a huge challenge. It's also a different mindset. The last 10, 15 years of DoD workforce management, true I think in most federal agencies as well, has been how to move people off the payroll, how to downsize, how to shrink. We're not in the recruiting business. I'll take a very simple kind of issue. Do we have a booth ready to go to job fairs? Well, a few weeks ago, we didn't have a booth ready to go to job fairs. So if I would call up and say, you know, XYZ is having a job fair, where's our booth? I would sort of get blank looks because until recently, that hasn't been our problem. Now it is our problem, and we want to approach it strategically. We don't just want to wait for the retirements to swamp us and to drain all the talent at once. What happened, in fact, you may recall this episode in New York City when Mayor Lindsay let the senior workforce of the New York City subway system maintenance unit all retire at once. Well, funny thing happened. The next several years, the trains didn't work because not everything was written down in the manual. And it was those senior guys, mostly guys, some gals, I suspect, but not many in that era, who knew how to make the trains actually run. And we don't want to let that problem happen to us. So we're trying to get ahead of that problem. On the civil side, we're just beginning this journey. We're just starting to put the tools in place necessary to achieve these objectives. And one of them, very simple one, is simply being candid with ourselves. How many people do we need to hire each year? Up to now, we've never set a goal. We've decentralized it, told you know, component managers, well, it's your problem, Bill or Paul, you know, you go hire, here the civil service rules, here's the list, you go hire somebody. We think we have to take a more strategic approach than that in order to be successful in the long term.
That's a good stopping point. Rejoin us in a few minutes as we continue our conversation about management with David Chu of the Department of Defense. This is the Business of Government Hour.